Hello and welcome to This Anthro Life. I'm your host, Adam Gamwell. I've been thinking a lot lately about interdependence, the idea that so much of the well-being of our world, for ourselves, whether physical or emotional, you name it, depends on those around us. Yet when we find ourselves up against a challenge bigger than ourselves, our interdependence becomes even clearer. When we move that scale even larger to a global climate crisis, interdependence becomes paramount. Climate change not only affects our everyday lives, but affects cultural history and cultural artifacts such as books and architectural styles, as well as more ephemeral practices like theater and song and language. How well we're able to face those challenges has to do with how well we tell stories. And how well we tell stories depends on what we choose to protect, preserve, and to make prosper in our cultures. If you've ever used the internet in the last 20 years, or even 20 minutes, you know as well as I do that there isn't a lack of information or stories online. But how much of ours and others' cultural heritage exists digitally? You know, how accessible is it, and who is able to contribute? These ideas as questions of interdependence really hit home for me during my conversation with Charles Henry, because he and his work highlight the importance of recognizing the fragility of our cultural heritage. Charles is president of the Council on Library and Information Resources, or CLEAR, which is a nonprofit that works with libraries, cultural institutions, and higher learning communities that helps improve research, teaching, and learning environments. Now, as we'll discuss, CLEAR empowers institutions with resources and funding to extend the reach and their impact of individual projects into a global institutional context of shared knowledge. So in other words, they blend preservation and protection with interdependence and interaction. But also in doing so, Charles shares how creating new digital technologies around cultural heritage allows us to acknowledge the limitations of our current competitive models between things like business and academia, but it also opens up new ways to tell better stories that bring people together rather than fragment. And this is something sorely needed as our interdependence on this planet and as a species continues to rise in urgency in the face of climate or military and political crises. We've got a powerful conversation to share today, and as you listen, I ask you to think about what interdependence and cultural heritage mean to you. And I invite you to share some of your responses and ideas with me. You can either leave me a voicemail through Spreaker, or you can send me an email at thisanthrolife@gmail.com, or drop me a message on Twitter or LinkedIn. I'm going to use some of your responses in our next newsletter on Substack, so I invite you to check that out as well. I'm excited to build this conversation further with you. And without further ado, let's jump into the conversation with Charles Henry. So first, I want to say, you know, thanks so much for joining us today on the podcast, Charles, on This Anthro Life. It really is a great pleasure to have you. I'm super excited to hear both your story and then kind of dig into some of the issues around the idea of the preservation of cultural memory. But first off, I just wanted to say thanks for joining us on the program and hope you're doing well today.
Thanks. It's a real privilege to be here, Adam, and thank you for the invitation.
So to kind of kick things off, one of the things I like to do on the show is kind of get a sense of you know, your own kind of superhero origin story and how you found your way into the world of thinking through the idea of libraries and digital information and how you came across and found yourself into this super fascinating world.
I am a comparative literature, let's say a lapsed comparative literature scholar. I have my doctorate from Columbia. And had a focus then on classical and medieval epics for the most part. And this was back in the long time ago, back in the 80s, and the job market was very tight. And I had been working in libraries all my life as kind of a library rat, and was, you know, fascinated by the idea of a library, certainly, and the way that libraries were used in my scholarship and those of my colleagues. And this was about the time that personal computers, digital technology was just starting to more than percolate. It was starting to rage. And so there was all this interest and confusion, skepticism, hope about what this new digital technology might bring to scholarship and higher education in general. So I, because the limited opportunities to teach wasn't such a bad thing. And I had the opportunity to take a job running the largest library at Columbia University at the time, Butler. which is a humanities history library. And that was, that's when I really got hooked on the juxtaposition of, you know, millennia of analog cultural heritage and this new wild frontier of digital technology, and how the two could coexist, how the two could complement one another, what were some of the advantages and disadvantages of this of these this new medium. And so I just jumped in and never looked back, and have was fortunate to work in some very forward-looking institutions, and ended up at the Council on Library and Information Resources about 13 years ago. And the council is a neutral body. It's largely a re-granting institution, and it allows for my staff and I to get involved across literally hundreds of institutions, hundreds of projects. And we're still wrestling with the confluence of digital technology and our analog cultural heritage. And it's great. It's been a great ride, as they say.
No, right on. I'm going to ask a dumb question as part of this, because I think it's really interesting to think about, on one level, what kind of the work of like the council does. And so part of it, you know, you mentioned that it's wrestling with basically our digital heritage, right? What does it mean to transfer and then translate cultural knowledge and information that came before into new formats? But also you noted that you work largely as a re-granting agency. And so I know for a lot of our listeners that maybe either in academia or kind of right outside of it, grants are always a huge part of how we think about projects and how we are able to, you know, find funding to do independent projects or research or work with an organization, work with a university like Columbia. So can you tell us a little bit about this? Like, how does the council work as a re-granting agency in terms of, are other organizations applying for projects and research and that then you sponsor and work with them, or how does that work?
Yeah, that's basically how it works. It's mostly at an institutional level as opposed to an individual level. What we do, I'll give you a specific example. One of our larger projects right now is called Digitizing Hidden Collections. And this is a North American project, involves Canadian institutions and those from America. And we work largely in what's called the GLAM community, which is galleries and libraries and archives and museums, cool name, and great, great folks. And what we do is we build communities. And we build communities, I like to say, of practice and of purpose. And we take what would otherwise be, say, an individual project at a certain college or a certain university, and it is put into the context of a larger international grant program that we manage. And that does a number of things. It allows for these individual schools and their staff to manage projects within a network of expertise. So instead of working alone at night and off hours with digitizing special collections, there's a real robust community of hundreds of people now who have either done this or are doing it. And there's a lot of expertise. There's a lot of shared knowledge that's important. It creates greater efficiencies and a greater effectiveness. And it also helps to establish more kinds of standardized practices and procedures. So what we do in this case, that so many institutions in North America have just extraordinary collections. And these collections can be photographs, they can be maps, they can be archives and newspapers, certainly books and such. And many institutions, and this includes, you know, even institutions that are wealthier than others, often don't have the financial backing to make these collections, which are often uncatalogued and certainly not digitized, make them available to the public as a public good. And so that's what we do. We work closely with the Mellon Foundation, Sloan Foundation, And we bring in often several million dollars a year that we then re-grant to these institutions in order to inculcate this sense of community and this sense of purpose. So we're reaching, we're actually extending the reach of these major foundations into institutions and regions that they otherwise would probably not get involved with.
Now that's very helpful to think about too, because oftentimes, you know, folks may hear, you know, hear of Sloan Foundation, right? And then think about, okay, what does it mean to find, you know, grants and works in that space, but also recognizing that they only work in so many directions, right? So I think what you're describing here is a really important space to think about. What is this in this? Because I think re-granting is this area that is, it might be familiar to some, but I think that a lot of folks that maybe even work in the space are not as familiar with, and understanding what does it mean to extend the reach of like philanthropic organizations and also help them get into other areas. So we need this kind of specialty directionality.
We've been managing the Digitizing Hidden Collections Project for several years now. And prior to that, we had a cataloging of hidden collections. All of this work brings these rare and special materials to the light of day, and the access then is sustained over time. So you're building a collective, a kind of commons of rare and valuable material that otherwise would be probably still obscured.
And I think it's such an important piece too, because you know the metaphor that I'm thinking of that you probably also get all the time is the Library of Alexandria's challenge, right? In terms of being a repository of physical knowledge that can then be wiped out if there's a natural disaster or fire or something. And then the cultural heritage that's lost in that regard. So this seems like incredibly important work. And also understanding, right, we have a global network of scholarship and information now, but oftentimes, I mean, I suspect that there's actually just a vast amount that has never been digitized, right? That has not been put out for an easier kind of commons access. And so the work is still ahead of us, I think. Is that correct? Or have we done a good job, or we got a lot more to do?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we're not. I mean, it's we have a program, a similar re-granting program for recordings at risk. And these are audiovisual materials that have become what they it's often called sticky. And the chemical components of the tape or the media has begun to separate, and these are this could be, you know, the only copy, let's say, of Gone with the Wind, or other kind of perhaps less dramatic but also very important kinds of information, cultural representation, cultural expressions. We have done this. Our grants are around $50,000, and we've probably laid out several million at this point. The scale of this project is upwards of $20 billion. So, you know, everyone tries. We make a stab at trying to address this, but the scale is very hard to grasp. The fragility of our legacy.
Mm. Now that's a both beautifully like said, but also highlighting the danger of this too, right? That is this kind of, there's a beautiful fragility to this. And so if I may give myself one more dumb question in this regard, in terms of like helping folks think about, you know, we're talking about like I love the idea of the GLAM as a consortium of groups, right? Galleries and
galleries, libraries, archives, and museums. GLAM communities.
It's got a great visual already to it, you know? So I think like, so part of it too, even thinking about this, right? So there is this importance of actually facilitating communication between different kinds of institutions. And so it seems like that's like one of the big elements of the council's work is to take a lot of independent groups that may or may not communicate with each other on a regular basis. And certainly, you know, I don't know if they're talking about collection sharing. So tell me a bit about that work. I think that's really interesting too, of how do we do coalition and network building across institutions as part of the council?
You know, that's a great question. And I think when you talk about building networks, people usually nod and, you know, we all think this is a good thing. And it's it's like in terms like innovation, everybody nods and says, oh, that's a good thing. These are extraordinarily difficult phenomena. And we do the network building as much as we can through the process of regranting and webinars and seminars and such. And we have one quick example. We have a postdoctoral program in data curation, and that has been going on for probably 8 years or more now. Their postdocs have just finished their PhD in a particular discipline, and they'll go to an institution and work on data in that field of study. We have representatives now of 23 different disciplines, sciences, social sciences, and humanities. And that's an example of a network. So we have hundreds of alums from this project. Each has her or his special field of research. So we're able to look at building networks, one, where there's a common interest in data curation, which is a very complicated, tricky kind of challenge these days. But it also allows us to see, you know, what's different between saving data, preserving data in climatological studies and or compared to medieval manuscripts like the Roman de la Rose and all of its manifestations. They're all data. If people think of data as like, you know, ones and zeros and numbers, but it's all data, and it's all, in many cases, a mess. And so we're trying to bring some coherence and cohesion to these processes. So that's an example of networking across disciplines and across different fields, with both similarities and distinctions involved. The one of the real challenges of network building are the kinds of impediments that higher education actually imposes on creating networks and creating collaborations, true collaborations. And when you look across the board of the thousands of colleges and universities that we have in the U.S. and that many of us work with on a daily basis, these schools are wonderful. Their mission is, you know, noble. Their vision is often profound. But they're also institutions that are competing with one another constantly. They compete for money. They compete for faculty, compete for grants, and compete for students. And it's this kind of inherent traditional competition between institutions and organizations that really can impede real networking, can impede a real kind of interdependence that so much of the rhetoric and so much of the raison d'etre of these schools is to, you know, in some case, just rise above the rest and be distinct and relish and, you know, in the idiosyncrasies of the institution. That's all cool, and we know that's important, but it at the level of what we're trying to do, it makes life a lot more complicated.
Yeah, no, and that makes good sense too. And I'm even just reflecting on my own graduate experience, but talking with colleagues that are doing postdocs now, for example, or folks that work in academia, or work in industry and then do partnerships with academia too, you know, across fields. And that brings true, right? That is actually one of the big challenges is, if we are to be institutions of higher learning and higher education, what does it mean to uphold that mission? But at the same time, like, you do have also, I'll sound vulgar here, but like a business to run, right?
My organization just did we were involved in, it was like every 5 years, strategic plan, you know, work out a strategic plan. And this time was really interesting because of the pandemic, the COVID disruption, and of course climate change, which hangs over so much increasingly hangs over what we do. So the idea of creating a strategy that you could follow closely for 5 years, let alone 2 years or three, that doesn't work today. And looking at the process of strategic plans that goes back, the mission statements, the strategies, the vision, basically most all of that goes back to the 1970s in business. And the name Peter Drucker, I'm sure, means a lot to you and others of us. And, you know, Peter Drucker was really helped create this, I would say, culture of strategy and mission. And the, you know, academe, the higher education, picked it up, and we have run with it ever since. But if you look at these, you look at most strategic plans, they're often quite similar, and it's often difficult to, if you kind of did a little mental experiment and blocked the name of the institution and read, you know, I did this and I don't recommend anyone doing it, at about 50 of these statements, it was really difficult to determine what kind of institution was represented by these statements, and almost impossible to determine what institution itself was saying this, because they were generic. And so I think this is, you don't get, and there's all kinds of ironies here, but in these statements, the terms growth was there, and high achievement, and innovation, and new ways of thinking, those terms were very common. What I didn't find in any of these was, we want to become more interdependent with other schools. We want to loosen our identity a bit in order to collaborate more effectively and efficiently. You just don't get it. And I don't mean to be glib, but the process itself of strategic determination causes difficulties to solve complex problems.
Hmm. No, but that makes actually great sense too, because once you're kind of working at a more abstract level of creating the barriers or pathways, they can become walls, right? In which then you get kind of stuck in a silo. And I think that, to your point too, yeah. No, thanks. I mean, that's one of the great challenges of our time, right? Is that, how do we de-silo our systems of knowledge and then also like potentially actualities of interdependence? So I think that's a really great, I mean, there's two things that you've mentioned so far that I think are really interesting challenges to this point around like actually recognizing interdependence and like recognizing what might be some ways that we actually can critically evaluate the barriers that we've ultimately put up. One of which is, which I love this example, what does a European illuminated manuscript share in common with climatological data? And the second is actually about the looming global challenge of climate change as a threat to how we can keep these data alive, in essence, right? Along with ourselves. And, you know, both these points give us a methodological challenge, but an existential one too, in terms of what does interdependence actually mean today? And how is it challenging some of these like strategic thinking frameworks that have indeed set business up to run a certain way? But obviously we live in a different time, almost a different planet at this point, right? You know, 50 years later. And that's a really interesting challenge that we're facing.
Yes, it is. Yeah. And we're not, you know, we're not really, we've been entrenched for so long, it's hard to get out of the way that we have been doing business. And I think that's, that makes the climate disruption and these other disruptive forces that much more urgent, I guess, at this point.
We're going to take a quick break to hear from this episode's sponsor. We'll be right back.
I think one of the more intriguing questions that more and more institutions, individuals, like organizations are going to need to be facing in the future is, you know, how do we deal with this larger existential threats? And so one of the elements I'm intrigued to talk to you about is like, how do we think about the fact that climate change like poses one of the biggest threats that we have to our cultural memory as humanity, but also as cultures and institutions and organizations too. How do we think about that? Like, how do you approach that problem through your work?
Well, I think if you look at, I've come to, I guess, kind of mentally migrate from climate change to climate crisis. I just think It truly is. It may be. In fact, anthropologists can call it the most dire existential crisis our species has ever confronted, and there's probably a good deal of truth to that. So, and from our Clear's perspective, from an information knowledge management cultural heritage perspective, what are aspects of this crisis? And one is the loss of habitable spaces on this planet. And that loss can entail a number of very disruptive and dire consequences. One is the loss of home, the diaspora of potentially tens to hundreds of millions of people moving into losing their home and moving into other parts of the world that are unfamiliar and perhaps inhospitable to them. There's also the physical threat of climate change and the effects of flooding and drought and fire and desertification. It's estimated that probably as much as 98% of cultural heritage institutions on this planet will be affected in some way by climate change. No one escapes this, no matter where you are or how wealthy you are. Something is going to disrupt you and your collections, whether it's rising seawater, whether it's the encroaching desert in certain parts of the world, wildfires, and even the change of the insects and that can destroy material culture, an increase of non-native species of insects, and the warming of areas that have not traditionally had air conditioning. That's a huge problem for collections, particularly books and paper-based media. So, from catastrophic sea rises to a hotter summer where you don't have wherewithal to cool your collections, this is just pervasive. And again, we're all touched by it. And the loss that this could entail of physical culture is, again, very hard to grasp. With the diaspora of people, you then lose, from an anthropological perspective, I would say, the more ephemeral aspects of culture, theater, performance, song, ritual, religious community acts that have been practiced for sometimes hundreds to thousands of years, the loss of particular languages themselves. So it just is from one some perspective, just unrelenting. And the last piece of this, the last part of the crisis, goes back to what we've been talking a bit about this afternoon. And that seems to me, it's important to acknowledge how difficult it is for us as human beings to work together at a large scale. And we've known about climate change since Jim Hansen gave his report decades and decades ago to Congress. We've known about this, and there has been precious little action. And the problem is in part, I think, cognitive, that we are, I don't know how to put it, but it's difficult, and we may not be too well equipped to truly work together on a scale that can address a problem of this enormity. And so we're not only probably caused this crisis, but we're at a disadvantage to solving it, I would say. And that's part of the ravages of climate change, it seems to me.
No, thank you for sharing that. I mean, that's such an important way to think through the issues that we're having. And I think, as we begin if somebody hears the idea of climate crisis, right, we tend to jump where you began to actually in terms of maybe loss of home and flooding and sort of environmental, quote unquote, or you know, spatial concerns, and like would lead to things like diaspora and movement, obviously in places themselves may get more hostile as more people need to find refuge. But then you raise this other interesting point too, that this means things like having to have more air conditioning in buildings that we didn't have to use as much before, or change the way that we're even thinking about, you know, the humidity or not of an area of collections, which can affect both physical materials if you have a bunch of wooden artifacts, but it can affect digital too. If it suddenly becomes very humid, it could mess with a computer, right? And, you know, and how we have not, you know, it's like realizing that we need to put all those pieces together, like does just also kind of underscore the enormity of the challenge. You know, but I also think you're right that like there is kind of a cognitive limitation. I mean, it makes me think of there's the phenomenon known as Dunbar's number, right? That it's every humans are kind of mentally, cognitively equipped to know personally about 150 other individuals. And that's kind of the extent at which we can then have a network of social people that we can count upon and that we can know. But obviously, right, we have the technology now, like Facebook or pick a social media thing, to see literally millions of people have, you know, followers or community members that we've never met. And it's this challenge because this, I'm thinking about this in context with there's another social science thinker called Benedict Anderson that came up with this concept of the imagined community. And it was really about how we developed the idea of the nation state through things like newspapers and mass media and like something that we all shared that we never had to have before. And so it's interesting to think through what are the tools which actually have been tools of material culture, newspapers and radio and a lot of mass broadcast as the ways of saying, here's what it means to be an American or a Canadian, right? Or a Mexican. And we use these tools of actual cultural building. And it's interesting because some of them are material. Some of them, to your point, are ephemeral, right? How do we act and how are we told to act in certain places? And so it is interesting to think about how we're going to run up to these kinds of challenges going forward when it's a question of what can we fall back on and what do we have to invent to go forward? You know, knowing, I think rightfully so, right, that we have a bit of a cognitive limitation in terms of how we can think of working as a group, right? Working as what is humanity as a whole while preserving difference, you know? I mean, one part I'm curious your thought about this too is, you know, you've kind of talked elsewhere before about the idea of the power of narrative and storytelling as ways of helping us kind of preserve, think through the participatory nature, like adding some coherence to dealing with change. Like, I want to hear your thoughts on this or if there are other tools kind of in your quiver, as it were, that we might pull out to think about how do we begin to address this issue?
You know, going back to us as a species, we are inveterate storytellers, and stories have occupied us before history, literally. And we've been telling each other stories for probably hundreds and hundreds of thousands of years. When you look at, and I don't want to be too abstract here, but we'll go back to social media. And I remember, you know, in a decade ago or 15 years ago, with the rise of some of these platforms, there was a great sense of, oh, we'll all be brought together. We'll be one community. You know, we can share stories. But the way that's worked has been more, I think, divisive than cohering. And part of that is that the stories, they're very small stories. They're kind of personal stories. They're very individualistic narratives, if you will. And that kind of storytelling tends to fragment communities, I think. And it's not a means to bring cultures together or societies together. So I think that, you know, some of the most important technical advances and discoveries of the last 20 years actually have stories as their basis, but it's the kind of storytelling that does not conduce to large-scale action, and in fact seems to very much conduce to polarization and fragmentation. So storytelling as a, you know, as a concept, let's say, can be very positive, but it also can be disruptive and negative. A story I would use as an example of the positive side for this talk is the Digital Library of the Middle East. And this was, we started this with a number of other organizations about maybe 7 to 8 years ago. And the impetus for the Digital Library of the Middle East was the just vicious destructive attacks by ISIS, also called Daesh, in the Middle East. And we all remember, I think, you know, daily newscasts where libraries were burned and mosques were burned and synagogues were burned and statues were blown up. And the assault on these communities by ISIS was very much a cultural assault as well as a physical kind of assault. So we got together, a group of us got together, and we're trying to figure out, what could we do? You know, we do not bear arms and we don't have blue helmets. And how might we address this? And we decided that a digital library was perhaps a means to not to resolve these problems, but to maybe give somewhat more hope for the future that what exists now can be preserved digitally. And if it is destroyed, you would still have a record of it, a good record, a high resolution record that could be used. And so we began to work with, I think over 100 institutions, in America, in Europe, and as importantly or more importantly in the Middle East. And what was good about this was that was the story. We're not going to solve this. But we may blunt the impact of this violence and blunt the impact of this loss if we work together. And to me, one of the more interesting aspects of this project was that it was digital. And we'd have these kind of thought experiments that if you went to the Middle East and there was, say, a gathering of representatives from 10 to 15 different countries there, most of them under serious threat at the time. And you said, we have a really large amount of money and we'd like to build a brick and mortar library somewhere to safeguard and house all these cultural treasures that are under threat. I think it's fair to say that no one would ever agree on where that would go, and for all kinds of understandable reasons. But the fact that it was a digital library gave it a neutrality and a kind of diffuse but shared space where everyone could contribute. Those who contributed were still responsible for their resources, but those digital surrogates would live on. And they could be sustained beyond local politics and beyond the local threat. So that story worked, I think. It worked pretty well. And ISIS is now very much in recession, I guess. The threats are still there, and they're now becoming increasingly climate threats as opposed to political and military threats. But the same story holds. Nobody's coming in and saving the day here, but working collectively can begin to help preserve and make accessible these wonderful resources. So that sort of epitomizes a distinction anyway between an analog culture and a digital culture. And there is an aspect here, and I call it digital diplomacy. And we have been working a bit with the State Department in the U.S. on this. That more and more these kinds of digital responses to crises are more easily acceptable and understandable. And the prospect of moving some forms of diplomacy into the kind of digital realm is intriguing and something that we're trying to help to pursue that as well.
Oh, that's fascinating. It makes good sense too, because there is, you know, both from what you're saying and then, and just other things that we've seen, that there is a semblance of neutrality in, I like how you put the kind of this diffuse but shared space of the digital, in that it's no one person owns it. And thankfully, with the connection of the internet and the interconnectivity of different services and, you know, technologies, that it also doesn't live in one place. And so meaning even too, that if something happens in one area to one server farm, it's not necessarily affecting another one elsewhere. And so I think that's a really interesting idea. And then, yeah, what this means for the question of digital diplomacy, I think is a really fascinating forward thinking question too, in terms of how do we tap into the structures of power that have the capacity, right, and the legal recourse to then also put in place international standards or policies that would then require certain kinds of, you know, collections or recommendations or you know, the way that we kind of interoperate. So I think there are some interesting questions there that, A, I applaud, but it sounds like a huge challenge to help, you know, move the State Department in this direction. But I think that's a great and brilliant insight in terms of what we can do with this, in terms of how we can tell that story and then what we can do with it. If we work and pull the levers of power that are also the ones that are best positioned to help us also continue to connect, right? Rather than divide.
Yep. Right. Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, one thing with that too, I'm curious about is you noted that as we are trying to build this interconnectivity space, you know, and then one of the other elements of CLEAR itself is that, you know, you work on the idea of helping create standards that can work interoperably across different contexts. And I think this is also something else that seems increasingly important too, especially as we, you know, think about, right, if we're working interculturally, if we're working with some groups that are under threat in different levels than another group might be, how do we kind of balance power differentials? And so I'm curious, I mean, this sounds like a very bland question, right? But like in your experience too, what is the role of having these kinds of standards in helping kind of make a, you know, whether it's a policy idea or just in terms of how we collect and share images, in terms of making them accessible in that element of being for the commons?
One response is that there is now a global organization called, it's IIIF, and if I can get my eyes correct, it's the International Image Interoperability Framework, and it's worth looking at. And this started as it's kind of a small beer operation many years ago, and now has a very large and vibrant international community that contributes to its platform all the time. Essentially, what it allows is for images and now and more recently texts and other kind of cultural objects that no matter what the metadata or the cataloging scheme or the description is, you drop it into IIIF and it becomes available internationally. And it's very simple. It's elegant, but it's one of these. To me, it's just exemplary of the kind of efficiency and I'd say celebration of sharing cultural heritage across regions and across societies, different parts of the world, using a platform that is, let's say, agnostic and just really accepts anything, and you can drop it in. And it's a, it's like the Switzerland of images, I guess. It's just neutral, and it's become beloved. And I use that term advisedly, but this is a way that you can make your culture and your heritage known in a way that is, frankly, inexpensive and quite vibrant. And a lot of the research that's done then is to create applications and tools that allow you and me to be able to use these beautiful images across many different countries, many different languages, many different projects in a way that we could never do that before. And so that's, to me, again, I think IIIF is a kind of proof of concept of what you can do when you really, you know, attack a wicked problem that a community literally of hundreds of technical people and managers and librarians and archivists were needed to help resolve.
Well, that sounds fascinating too. And this is like, you know, scratching my nerd itch in terms of that. There's always been this interesting question. I mean, I'm coming from the field of anthropology, but regardless of the field itself, I mean, one of the issues that we would always discuss back in the day, and that I still think is an issue. So I'm actually why I'm really excited to talk with you here is to ask the question of if we're having these kinds of standards and we're able to bring together all forms of kind of human cultural data. Obviously, it's an ongoing work project, but like, are there ways that we can make that, you know, in terms of accessibility and searchability for addressing actually some of these like planet level issues we have with the climate crisis and, you know, whether it is, you know, finding stories of indigenous Peruvian farmers that have worked with like drought ridden conditions for hundreds of years. How have they done this? Right. And what stories do we have? Or how have we seen, you know, the Americans, Plains Indians and Native Americans working across different forms of agricultural production or, you know, or any of these different kind of elements. It makes me wonder too, in terms of what are the possibilities there? I guess I'm hopeful that there are ways that we can also, you know, think about this in terms of cultural heritage, but this is also our collective problem solving, I guess, is the way I'm thinking about this too. And how can we tap into that?
I think that's, I really like that. And it's when you look at a platform, let's say, not just as a place to display information, but a place that helps to make decisions, informed decisions, a platform, or let's say more accurately, a digital environment that has a more almost, and that, again, this is a little on the edge perhaps, but it's organized in more in a biological way, an organic way, than just in the traditional bits and bytes. You want an environment where information flows freely across, that you can combine and recombine all kinds of data and information and images and predictions in ways that are very, very difficult to do now. If you look at these kinds of technological constructs more as representing, you know, cognitive processes as opposed to arithmetic and algorithmic processes, I think we would get closer to mimicking not only ourselves, but what we need, or let's say even our better nature, in ways to address these problems that we don't have now. A footnote to this is that so much of in climate change and the climate crisis, so much of the science is understandably locked up in various journals. And this goes back to your observation about silos. So probably the most important medium of scientific information pertaining to climate change is behind a firewall, or firewalls, plural. And is rather expensive, and most people can't access it. And so again, we're confronted with a kind of existential infrastructure challenge, that our most effective means of production and dissemination are in certain respects extraordinarily limiting and potentially self-defeating. And that's we need to wrestle with this.
Yeah, no, I agree too. And I love this description too, in terms of thinking about how do we rethink what it is that technology is doing. One, platforms not as like repositories for just showing something off, right? But actually as arenas in which they can help us make better decisions and we can think through together. And then yeah, what is the correlation in accessibility of knowledge as part of those too, in terms of can they be as organic as culture actually is, right? There are no actual borders in culture, right? We define them. But, you know, how we interact with one another is how we make culture. And even just this existential infrastructure point, I think is super interesting. I was just talking with some friends the other day that, you know, Nature, one of the most prestigious biology magazines or journals, peer-reviewed journals out there, is now offering open access for anybody if you pay $12,000. That's insane if you think about that, right? Because that's like most you know, postdocs or like a PI is not going to have that kind of extra money from a grant to make it open access. And so it's self-defeating to your exact point, right? Some of the most important knowledge we need to get, we can't get out to the public for paywalls. Like, this is a literal paywall of $12,000.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, in my day, that was more than I made as a research assistant. So, I mean, that was beyond the pale.
Indeed, right? But I think this is actually a really, really wonderful point that I think is worth wrestling on. We may have to have a second conversation following up to think through this also, because there's so much here that it's been actually really wonderful to talk with you. You've opened up a lot of doors in my head to think with here.
This has been a really provocative and kind of, I think, a lovely conversation from my perspective, Adam, and I really appreciate, again, the invitation to talk. I think we've covered a lot of the major issues and the major challenges, and my only salutary comment would be that we do seriously, honestly need to work together to address the world in which we find ourselves, and I hope we can do that.
Thanks once again to Charles Henry for joining me on the podcast today. It's been a powerful conversation. You can check out more about Charles' work as well as CLEAR, the organization, and some of the great projects they are putting together on their website, which you can find linked in our show notes. One of the things I found very powerful about this conversation is this idea of how do we tell stories that bring us together versus fragment, and wrestling with what this means for our common technological ways of engaging online through things like social media. So I'm curious about your thoughts on this. What are some ways that we could tell bigger and better stories that show how we can work together and solve some of these big problems that we're trying to face in terms of climate crises or cultural heritage preservation, or even just telling a better story about what it means to be human in 2022 in the world of capitalism? And as noted up top, go ahead and drop me a line at thisanthrolife@gmail.com or on LinkedIn or Twitter or voicemail on Spreaker, and let's get in touch. I want to hear about your notions of interdependence, what this means to you, how it relates to cultural heritage, and we'll be telling some of these stories on the next newsletter. You can find the link to our Substack newsletter also in our show notes. And once again, thank you so much for joining us here. It's always a pleasure to be here with your ears and your mind, and hey, let's keep on going. For This Anthro Life, I'm Adam Gamwell, and we'll see you next time. This episode was produced and edited by Imani Nichols with Whisper and Mutter.